welcome in. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is the newest All Ball. At the time of this recording, Kawhi Leonard out for the year with a torn ACL, yet the Clippers find a way to win a game. That's crazy. Rick Carlisle just resigned. What else? Kevin Durant said, I'm Kevin Durant. Don't you know who the F I am? I'm Kevin Durant. And that game's going to be played tonight. So this is going to drop the morning after Kevin Durant has a chance to eliminate the Bucks with one more Herculean effort. Look, I've been on this train for a long time. I thought he was the best player going back, 5 years ago? I understand how good LeBron is. The difference is KD has that Kareem Abdul-Jabbar unblockable shot, unstoppable offense. You got to hope he misses or gets super physical with him, obviously. And I thought he's been the best player. That's why he went to Golden State. Like, people get it twisted all the time. Like, well, 73 wins. They didn't win a championship. They were a flawed team. And that era of the Warriors was about strength in numbers. He basically had to take the place, not just of Harrison Barnes, but like three other dudes they had to jettison. I've been trying to tell you, I thought he's the best player. And what we saw the other night was about as good as it gets. Now, look, he may be terrible after I record this, but Kevin Durant, 7 feet tall, can handle pass, starting to learn to be a better passer. He's not LeBron. He'll never be LeBron as a passer, but starting to be a much better passer. He's always been a good rebounder, always. And defensively, he improved during his time in Golden State. And the other night, he was incredibly important, not just with his versatility, but his rim protection at times. So if they can get by the Bucks with a hobbled Harden and without Kyrie Irving and all, remember, this is not like LeBron with the Cavs. And he was great, obviously, his first time when they got to the finals and he had the 25 straight points against the Pistons. But LeBron's teams many times in his prime were built around him. That's not how this was built. This was built for three guys and then just a bunch of parts. You take away two other stars or you have the one that's – it's a very different team, a very different way of playing in short order. Now, the Bucks, kind of like the Jazz, it's hard to adjust on the fly if you're playing against such a different team. So they'll probably win game six and Jazz will probably win game six. But I still got to tell you, the things that you see Kevin Durant doing are otherworldly. As for Rick Carlisle, I think it's pretty obvious you're seeing a trend around the league. I hope Jamal Mosley gets the gig. He's been a friend for a long time. He played for my dad in AAU in Colorado. I think you're going to see a lot more 40-year-old former player on some level, mostly NBA, but Jamal was an NBA player. 40-year-old, more relatable guy coaching these teams. I think that's what you're going to see. And I'm fascinated. There's going to be massive, massive movement in the NBA. And look around the league now. You're talking about Boston is open. Dallas is open. New Orleans is open. These are teams with big-time players, right? Now, big-time players are harder to coach. And Portland is open. Think about that. I think Ty Lue has done an incredible job. Incredible. Is there anything they run X and O wise? No, but in terms of figuring out the matchups and figuring out how to win the series, going small against Utah, look what he did with Dallas and the adjustments he made from, you know, stop playing Rondo, Trey Mann at the five. Ty Lue's been really good. There'll be more guys like Ty Lue on the sidelines, I feel like, next year in the NBA. All right, let's get you to our part two of Josh Pastner. Okay, so when we last talked to Josh, he had just gotten the Memphis job. Now, keep in mind, to get the Memphis job, he thought they were trying to retain his assistant. He planned on going with Coach Calipari to Kentucky, and he walks in the athletic department director's office, and he offers him, do you want the job? He thinks he means the head assistant job. All right, we'll let Josh take it from there. A reminder, you can listen to the Doug Gottlieb Show daily, 3 to 6 Eastern Time, 12 to 3 Pacific on the iHeartRadio app, foxsportsradio.com, SiriusXM 217 or 203, or on Fox Sports Radio. Here's Josh Pastner, part two. Okay, Josh, so when we last spoke, you had just gotten the job. Okay, so And you walked in, the AD was like, do you want it? And you thought he was talking about being the assistant coach. And turns out he's talking about being the head coach. Now, here's what I heard. You, again, put truth to rumor. Okay. I heard that it got done so quickly that you actually have the same contract as John Calipari. The only difference was like the monetary compensation, right? There's a bunch of fine print stuff like, yeah, let's just get the deal done. Any accuracy to that?
Doug, it happened. Everything happened so fast. Doug, I got the job. There was, and God bless that I got the job because, as I mentioned before, I was just at the right place, right time. I skipped 150 steps. A million people are more deserving to be the head coach at Memphis than I was. So when I got the job, there wasn't an interview process. It was just, do you basically want the job? There was nothing. It was just because they had to hire somebody at the time because, you know, so many coaches got raises, you know, because nobody wanted to follow Calipari. They all said, yeah, I'd be interested. And then all of a sudden their current school would give them a big raise. So I say all that to say it happened so fast. There's a lot of truth to that rumor that I was not making the same financial package as Coach Calipari. But it was all basically the same thing because it was just, you just had to shift everything over and change the name from John Calipari to Josh Pastner. A couple of monetary figures were a little less, but you just needed to go right in to become the coach, you know, and how I got the job. It was just, like I said, it was just basically, do you want the job in a sense? And it just happened that quickly, that fastly, based on everybody else getting pursued for the job said no.
So you're 31 years old and you mentioned like your recruiting class, the Bledsoes and the DeMarcus Cousins of the world and the John Walls, they all go to Kentucky, right?
You put together. No, they all wanted to play for John. They were never the entire time in recruiting. It was John Calipari, John Calipari, John Calipari. So, there was no, people were asking about that. Where is there any, no, none whatsoever. If at the time, if my son had a chance to play for Josh Pastner, 31, or John Calipari in a future Hall of Famer at the time, he's now obviously in the Hall of Fame, go play for John Calipari. I got it. Like, I totally understood it. There is, I got the whole deal.
Okay. So look, you dreamed of this your whole life and you played for Lute. You'd worked under KO at Arizona, Kevin O'Neill at Arizona. And you obviously worked under Coach Cal. Your first year, what's your persona like? Like, I put in practice plan together, you can do that. Okay. But in terms of how you carry yourself, when you come to the, like, when were you, as an assistant coach, when would you get to work?
You know, it was, what was great was, as an assistant coach, I worked for guys who were very, even though they were all different, they kind of let you, they wanted you to get the job done. So you had to be self-motivated. You had to be just, you know, motivated and driven internally to go get the job done. They maybe didn't have a set office hour time, but I enjoyed getting in there early. I'm an early morning guy.
Under Cal, did you guys have like a recruiting meeting every day or a staff meeting every day?
A lot of times we'd meet at dinner. We'd go to dinner or a late night thing. He would drink Dunkin' Donuts coffee all the time, 10 at night. We'd have a late night, you know, meeting late in the evening, you know, or getting a meal, going to get a bite to eat. You know, a lot of our meetings were, I mean, we'd meet sometimes during the day, but a lot of the meetings were in the evenings and we would just do that. Where Coach Olson, you know, a lot of the meetings were in the late mornings, early afternoon. But you know, what was interesting in the meetings, both those guys, they wanted to meet to be organized, but there wasn't a lot of wasted time either. They kept moving. Both guys were very busy. They had, you know, at the level John Calipari, Lute Olson were at, had other things going on in their life at a very high level, you know, other than just basketball at the time.
What did I missed this honestly in our first one, but I want to circle back to you. I thought, here's what Eddie Sutton did, what I thought was genius to maybe not relate to the players, but to get to know the players. We had a rule. If you're in Stillwater, you had to come to the office once a day. You had to come in and sign a piece of paper that you made eye contact with somebody on staff. If they were there, if not, you just come to the front and sign to see Mary Lee Draper, who ran the office, right? And I thought it was great because you always, they felt like they always knew where you were. They always had a handle on what was going on in your life. And a lot of times you wouldn't really talk about anything special, just like, hey, what's going on? What are you up to today? You know, maybe are you getting in the gym? Are you getting one in, getting a workout in or whatever? But a lot of times, not even that, just kind of BSing around. But I thought that was a way. And then every once in a while, a coach would come and sit on the couch in our locker room and watch, like, like Beavis and Butthead or Martin was on back in the day, right? Like Martin Lawrence. And they would watch, he would watch that stuff and he would ask questions and maybe only like 5-10 minutes, but you would feel like he would know what was going on in your life. What it, like Lute Olson, John Calipari, how did those guys connect with the younger generation?
Well, what was interesting was at Arizona, Arizona was a different setup at the time than Memphis. Arizona, our offices were over. There was no practice facility at the time when I was at the University of Arizona. The offices had a big glass window that looked down onto the floor. Everything was in McHale Center. McHale Center was where we played our games. But in McHale Center was the academics, was the food, was practice, was the weight room, and the game floor. So you had everything right there. Besides the living quarters, you had to be in McHale. So just by the locale of where everything was, you were going to be seeing the coaches no matter what, and guys were going to pop up into the office to see the coaches and that Coach Olson, again, things were different than they are now. In the summer, we weren't allowed. There was no allowed individual skill instruction. Guys sometimes would go home. You know, there wasn't allowed.
By the way, and we'll get to this later, easily the dumbest rule in the history of man, that you have the best coaches in the world who recruit kids to play for them, but you're not allowed to coach them out of the season, you know, in the summer, which that rule made no sense. You're like, you're begging third parties to get involved if you do it that way.
And it's obviously changed now. Yes. But at that time, you're correct. So it was a little bit different. And so when summer happened, what was interesting, people would just go home. There wasn't a lot of people staying. The guys weren't staying around at the college campuses during the summer, unless they had to for an academic reason. Most people went home. So that was a little different. So the guys were able to see the office. You know, you'd see guys within the facilities at McHale Center when we were there. What was interesting at Memphis, Doug, was the fact that our offices were not at the location of the current of the practice facility, nor were they in our academic center. Our offices were totally a separate building. So it was a total separate building. Now, and I always thought that was made it tough. And I remember when I became the head coach at Memphis, using that same thing that Coach Sutton did about making him come to the office daily to see them. Otherwise, if it was not a practice day, like where you're practicing, you know, if you're out of season, you might not see the guy. You could go multiple days without seeing your team because unless you have to literally go search them, because a lot of the guys wouldn't come over to the office because there was just no, it was just as such out of the way. So, but Coach Calipari, you know, he did a genius thing by, he had this house where he lived. He lived literally 30 seconds from campus. And obviously it was a beautiful home, but he lived 30 seconds from campus and he had us over there all the time. When I say us, I was part of the staff, but he would have the players over there all the time. And he did a tremendous job of just connecting with the players by the time and effort he spent with them at his own home. And I think that was a big difference and how he did that. Whereas at Arizona, everything was in the facility. And we still went to Coach Olson's home at, you know, for recruiting visits and stuff like that. But for Coach Calipari's home, we guys would go over there a bunch just randomly because he literally lived next to campus.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
Okay. But taking over a job where you were an assistant and, you know, Cal is the guy, right? Like he just, he's a force of nature. How do you go about making it your program without being a jerk, right? Without being on the other hand, like, look, you're the head coach now. And, but that 18 inches is the biggest move ever. Plus you're 31 replacing like an all-timer, a Hall of Famer. How did you go about getting into the job for first for the players that remained, right? And then obviously in Memphis as a city that loves basketball, but is it's a tough place. Not just a tough guy to follow, it's tough on whomever, right? Like fucking Tubby Smith is unbelievable, right? And like that place ate Tubby up. So how did you go about making that move mentally?
There's only, you know, there's only three coaches in the history of Memphis who have not, who've been a head coach there, has not been fired, who've left on their own. Gene Bartow, John Calipari, and Josh Pastner. I mean, that's how hard, you know, that you're right. I mean, like, think about Larry Finch, who I think should, there should be a 30 for 30 on Larry Finch, the, what he did, how great of a player he was back in the day. I don't know how many people really understand about Larry Finch, one of the great players in history of college. An incredible player, incredible shooter, chose Memphis during just a time. It was during all the you know, where Dr. King was assassinated. It was a lot of race riots during that time period and a lot of things going on in Memphis. And he chose Memphis at the time, which really brought the city together. You know, of every background came together because of basketball, partly because of what Larry Finch choosing to stay home. It meant during a really hard time in Memphis with a lot of issues going on. And so, and then he became the head coach and was the winningest coach in the history of Memphis until John Calipari eventually surpassed him. That being said, I mean, the guy's a hero, Larry Finch. He's a legend. He's incredible. And they were so tough on him as a coach. It was unbelievable, you know, and that just showed you how tough that job is. And you know, I still say if people should look at the story of Larry Finch, there should be a 30 for 30 on him. But I say all that to tell you that you're 31 taking over, and you're right, Doug. What makes it hard is you can't be John Calipari. I had to be myself. I went around to more speaking engagements. Because, and when you're talking about the office, about getting in early, you know, I felt when I became the head coach there, I love being in the office and I love working. I love my job, but I really felt in that first year, I had to get out to as many like people I could go to speak. I couldn't live in the office. I had to get out there and in the community and just like keep everybody connected in some way.
Like, give me the most random place you popped in on.
I was just going every, I mean, Doug, there was not a speaking engagement I said no to. There wasn't anything. I was talking to everybody. I mean, it didn't matter. Restaurant. I was trying to rally the city because there was such an upsetness in the city for John Calipari at the time leaving because they loved him so much. He was so successful. They took it personal that he decided to take the Kentucky job because they loved him and he won so much and he did so much for the community and city.
Right, and I think the idea is like, hey, if you can compete for a national championship here, why do you need to go to Kentucky? Right. Those of us who we've kind of been outside of, you know, far enough from the forest to see the trees, understanding it's been different at Kentucky, right? Like he's been able to select, not necessarily recruit as much for a long time at Kentucky, but I do understand the, like, if you're happy and we're going to pay you whatever, and you're
were going to pay him whatever, that he'd probably made more money at Memphis than Kentucky. You know what I mean? So, you know,
like literally we'll pay you whatever it takes.
And so my message was the entire time was, look, this has got to be like, it's got to be, you know, our team, our city, our program, because I said, I can't be John Calipari. Because I said, John Calipari, the only way to get John Calipari, you're going to need to hire John Calipari back. I kept saying that. I can't be John Calipari. So everyone's going to have to, is going to have to back me, support me, be behind me. Because I said, the guy, he was winning 35 games a year. That's not happening. It's not. John Wooden didn't do some of the things he. Mike Krzyzewski, Bob Knight. He was in a class of his own in those last 4 years at Memphis. It was the most wins in a 4-year time period in the history of the NCAA. So I kept telling people, if you want to repeat that success, you need to get the only way that's going to happen is get John Calipari back. But everyone's going to have to come to the acceptance that he's moved on to Kentucky. And so I was trying to send that message that we've got to rally behind me in a sense and the program to keep the thing moving forward.
Was that if you could do it again, would that be your message?
Well, it's not that if I could do it again. No, I would probably. I think at the time I had to do that because we had a rally that, the city was hurting. And I thought it was the right message. And so, if I knew what I knew now, I would say, hey, everything's going to be okay. I would probably wouldn't have stressed as much and just said, and I would have just, I would have known if I knew what I knew now, I know what we would have run offensively, defensively. That's obviously part of growing. But at the time, the city was, I'm telling you, because I was.
Doug,
I was there with the people loved John. They loved him in that city. And when he left, I've told Coach Calipari this, because they loved him so much, they were hurt when he left. I mean, look, you know how it is, Doug. A lot of times when people leave or they get fired, the fans are, they're ready for a move. With him, there was such a love affair. And because he won a lot, he had done a lot of good in the community. There was a lot of positives. He had made a lot of positive differences in the community. So when he left, the fans were hurt. So to kind of get the excitement back and the enthusiasm back, I said, hey, we got to rally around the program, and that's what we got to do. So I don't think there was any other message you could do, because unless they wanted John Calipari to be coming back and walking through that door, which wasn't happening, I think they had to accept that at that time.
When you got there, I don't think he was doing the dribble drive motion, right? I think that had gone away some. I don't know if it was part of what you guys did. Did you like that? Did you like that style?
I think, again, and we talked about this last time, what makes Coach Calipari a genius is the fact that he could look around the corner and see in a corner spot in a shopping center and say, man, that if I had a pizza place right there, you can make just an unbelievable amount of money just having and charge this by the slice, and I think the same thing, because Vance Wahlberg deserves a lot of credit, but with the dribble drive, I think, he's the one that kind of started it. Vance Wahlberg. Coach Calipari got it from Coach Wahlberg, flew out there, met with him, brought him in, all those things. And Coach Calipari, the genius that he was or is, then took the dribble and marketed it in a way that it was, it was incredible. And now, again, he had to coach it. He did some things to his own liking and stuff, but he tailored it to what he felt was best for him. But then his marketing, his ability to market. I mean, think about it, Doug, and I say this, I mean, really, a lot of the things that, he made the dribble drive, obviously, like I said, Coach Vance Wahlberg started it, but Coach Calipari made it famous. Coach Calipari started the pro days, he kind of started the one and done thing, where it's, there's a lot of
things he started with his marketing. Here's the beauty to him. Okay. And this is, again, we both have the same thing with Cal. We both think he's amazing. But we also understand, Sharif Abdurrahim had been a one and done. There's been, Duke had a couple of.
But it wasn't marketed, Doug. It wasn't marketed.
That's the point, right? Where it's really amazing. And you see that in business as well, where it's there are plenty of coffee companies that have done what Starbucks had done, but Starbucks finds a way to kind of get it and almost claim it as their own. And you're like, wait a second. It's Aerosmith says this, and Aerosmith says amateurs borrow, professionals steal, in terms of, music riffs and whatever. Right. And that's Cal. He finds something. And he's not only does he understand it and get it and go that'll work, but it'll go all right. But then I put my stamp on it and I market it my way, and it kind of becomes my thing, even if it's not my thing. That was brilliant.
No, there's a lot of brilliancy with that. And obviously, which then attracted many great players. And as we talked about, he's a great coach. But then it's just like the having like the like Drake become part of like Kentucky program now. You know what I mean? I mean, you
know, it's like so many coaches push away thing like, man, I don't want Drake, right? Or he's just come on, come on. Like it gets like LeBron engaged, it gets Drake, like it's okay. So now you're managing all this stuff, you're putting together a roster. Did you have Elliot Williams sitting out, or did you get him to transfer?
No, Elliot Williams, he came to Memphis because of the reason, and it was a sad reason. His mom unfortunately had breast cancer and didn't have a long time, and so he went. And he's from Memphis, Elliot. Okay. And so he came back home. He wanted to have his mom and his family to be able to see him play in person with the amount of time she had, and he had a great year for me. And thank the
okay. So you got Elliot Williams, the Duke transfer, brilliant kid. As your point guard, your leader. You said you got to figure out how to play, right? And I mentioned you had, you got Calipari, you got Luke, you got KO, and like, look, KO. I'm sure we could do another pod on working for KO. Maybe that airs. Maybe it doesn't. Like, because there's a lot going on there, but. The brilliant basketball guy. I don't think anyone would argue otherwise. And he's had his own, I got to do a pod with him. Like he's had his own, like the people he's worked with are amazing. How'd you decide how you want to play? Like, did you just go sit in a dark room? Did you watch film? Did you have your staff? How'd you decide Josh Pastner, how I want to play year one at Memphis?
You know, Doug, you know, here's what I would tell you. This is part of, I've been a head coach now for 12 years. And so, I was fortunate I really believe I have gotten better each year as a head coach, which is just natural growth. I've had really good assistant coaches that have worked for me that I've learned so much from. I've been very fortunate in that area that I've been able to improve and get better because I've had good people that I've worked, that have worked with me. And then on the same time, I've really tried to be a student of the game and be open-minded and continue to evolve. And so one of the things that I didn't do a good enough job on early at Memphis is I felt I did not have a certain style of how I wanted to play both offensive and defensive. I thought I was changing year by year. And I look back now, we won a lot of games and thank the good Lord, we won a lot of games. And the reason we won a lot of games was because I had great players and great assistant coaches, and who covered for me in both areas. But I really, looking back in my position, that I didn't do a good enough job of in making sure that we stayed consistent of our style of play. Yeah, you're going to make
tweaks. So again, now 12 years in, again, if you could go back, we're all like, you get people like, well, you can't look back. Like, of course you do. You look back and you learn from the past and you try and make a better future, right? So if you could go back, you would have installed a system and stuck to that system?
Yes. And as much as we won, Doug, we would have won even more. I really believe that. And
here's the problem with that.
But
here's the problem with it, okay? This is outside of perspective. I believe you're right. Okay. I believe that's the way to do it. I think you get more out of less, and you can also recruit to a system. Instead of constantly, and I understand that the challenge in trying to evolve and fit something to the personnel that you have, that's it's like the Belichick thing, which is like, hey, let's just go try and win this week. And then next week, we'll try and go win next week. And they're amazing at it. But I tend to agree with you, especially if it's a system that you know and that you believe in. And I mean, I think it's the Wisconsin thing, right? Like, I don't love their system, but they recruit to their system and they coach to their system, and guys understand, like, you want to play, this is how you're going to have to play. We'll tinker with some things. We'll adjust some things. They become but I do think that's, but it's also hard when you're, again, like, even though you're on the staff, that's like trying to reprogram somebody else's stereo, right? Like, you don't shit. I don't know how to, this is not me. This is not what I would do. And it's not how, okay. So what did you do your first year? What was your style?
You know, and you're right. And so I had, as the head coach, I was trying to making sure that that we were good in things that the guys knew how to be good at, that they just had been doing for a few years in the previous years.
For example?
Well, we did do a lot of dribble drive stuff. We did do a lot of drive and kick and things like that. So, but I also in my time at Arizona, we did what was interesting, and it's gone away now. And I still think it's a tremendous offense. But we ran a lot of three out, two in with a flare screen, re-screen type of action. It was a motion offense. It was really good. Yeah. It was excellent. But it's different now because, you know, not everyone's playing with a true four and a true five. You know what I mean? The game has evolved.
But it's like Bill Self with the high low. You can evolve it into.
Exactly. We might have changed offensively. But the nomad with me, and there's two things. We were excellent at high field goals being assisted. We were always one of the best in the country or in the best in the league. Our ball movement and the way we moved the ball. And my whole saying was that our go-to man was the open man. The open man was the go-to man. I said that every day, all day. So we always move the ball. People would say, well, your offense looks like, then you just scrap something. I said, how? And I would always take that personal because I said, you know, that's a shot to our players because they played so unselfish. Because you look at our assist and we celebrated the hockey assist. We celebrated the assist. We celebrated whatever it took to get our ball movement was great. That was one. And two, we were really good defensively. We were always good defensively. Now, you could say that, man, your offense got stagnant here or you didn't do this here. Or you didn't use this guy the right way here. I get that. And I look back and saying, you know, there's some things like maybe I should have used a different type of ball screen action, or I should have done this or that. But we were good in those two areas with all that being said. And because we played unselfish and that was something that we were on about all the time, about finding the open man, turning down a good shot for even a great shot. So, but I think we could have even, you know, so I try to, going back to your question, I try to combine the two. But it was an evolving process, Doug, because in my first year there, we signed the number one recruiting class in the country. I had to then try to fit things coming in as a bunch of young guys. And I kind of changed some things my second year on how I played offensively my first year. It was just, you know, and then we were a high turnover team. As much as we were having high assists, we also had high turnovers. And part of that, I look back that we didn't have I changed year in, year out with some of our system stuff offensively, which probably wasn't the right thing to do. What I was really proud of our staff, you know, we had a lot of guys leave Memphis to become head coaches. Jack Murphy became the head coach at Northern Arizona, and he did a great job at Northern Arizona. He's now the associate coach at Arizona. Damon Stoudemire left Memphis for me and became the head coach at Pacific. You know, I had Willis Wilson was the head coach, as I mentioned, and came to me and then became the head coach at Texas.
Can I tell you my Willis Wilson story?
Tell me a Willis Wilson story.
This is the best one. So I was doing
great
a game.
Man, Willis Wilson, incredible human being.
Incredible man. Okay.
Yeah, incredible man.
Where I have one of my first guy ever when I did an audition at ESPN and my first games at ESPN. And then he was a studio host for me. It's a guy named Dave Revson. He's basically the face of the Big Ten Network. So we're doing a Rice game. Okay. And God, he had a big guy who was like 6'4", 6'5", like short arms. I can't remember his name. But he ended up making the NBA. And like, I thought the only negative I could tell you about Willis Wilson, one negative as a human being and as a coach, is I didn't think he was good at substitutions. I didn't. But people should look back at what he did at Rice, considering not only was it a bad facility at the time, but there was a curtain behind one of the baskets. And they had a badminton court.
Yep. Yes. Yes. That's correct.
And kids were playing fucking badminton while they're playing a college basketball game, right? You're like, how do you recruit to a place where they're playing badminton while you're playing a college basketball? Okay. But so here's where Willis Wilson is an absolute gem of a human being. I got to remember who they're playing. Playing somebody towards the end of the year. It's a big game, decent crowd. It went, kind of almost subbed himself out of the game, but they end up winning. And after the game, you know, we take off our headsets and he comes over. And, you know, like, I'm a big handshaker. Every win I ever had at Oklahoma State, every win I ever had at Notre Dame, I always shook my head coach's hand and congratulate him. I always shake the other coach's hand. Big at shaking hands. And so I go to shake his hand. He's like, I'm a little under the weather. Like, let's just elbow bump. This is like, I'm going to go 2006 or something, right? This is way before anybody did the elbow thing. And Dave Revson's a bit of a germaphobe. And we go walking out and he goes, that Willis Wilson, what a hell of a guy, right? Like how thoughtful of is he that he would, anybody else would just, I'm not feeling great, but I just won a game and I'm shake your hand. I'm even give you a hug. And he does the elbow thing. Willis, not a germaphobe, but just smart and understanding. Brevson and I always talk about Willis Wilson. We're like, great guy, didn't shake hands because he wasn't feeling great. That's awesome. So you're trying to figure some stuff out. What's it like? What's it really like to recruit in the city of Memphis? Right? Because Memphis, here's the, again, outsider. You've lived it, you've done it. Outsider's perspective of, man, that shit is wild, right? Like, because Memphis has some great basketball players, but you almost feel like you take Memphis kids, there's just expectations that are so beyond what they're actually capable of. And so you take them, you have to play them. If you don't play them, everybody's going to kill you in the community. If you do play them, they might not be either ready or have played the type of college basketball at both ends and that you need to win. There's also conflicting alliances, right? Not everybody, just because you're from Memphis doesn't mean you like everybody from Memphis. Like that shit's got to be wild. What was it actually like to recruit Memphis kids in Memphis?
No, Doug, there's a lot of intensity being recruiting kids from Memphis. And again, let me just be very clear. I love my time at Memphis. Love the job was awesome. And I love recruiting in Memphis. That being said, there was a lot of high expectations that come with it. Now, it is hard for someone to come in and get a Memphis kid. Now, like John Calipari prior to me, he was able, especially those last 4 years, he was able to get guys outside of Memphis because he was, you know, national. He can go pluck guys anywhere. I really, when I got the job, really locked in and try to focus on some of the local talent there. And there were some great guys coming up. And we were fortunate that we were able to get some great players. And we were also able to get a guy like Will Barton. And in fact, his brother, Antonio Barton, who ended up helping me win a lot of games early on as well, too. But I say all that to say there was a lot of expectations. And a guy like Joe Jackson, who was a great player and was a McDonald's All-American, and so much the pressure that was put on Joe from being in that city, in that locale. And he's a great player, Joe. And 4 straight years, you know, going to the NCAA tournament, one of the top five in Memphis history in points, rebound, points, assists, steals, wins, just an incredible player. You know, I could see it on the pressure on him. And we had other guys on the team as well, too, from Memphis. What was interesting, Doug, two things. One, I can remember multiple times late game situations, because the way that the guest tickets were always behind our bench, you know, like the players' tickets or the players' guests were behind our bench. I can't tell you how many times late games or something, you know, the different coaches in the stands and the AAU coach would be screaming, "What you got, coach? What you got? You know, give it to my guy in this situation. You better give it to him over." You know, they all wanted their guy to have the last. I mean, it was unbelievable. You can hear it in the background.
And yeah, your second team, right? You got your second year. You got Will. You got Joe Jackson, Tarik Black. You got Chris Crawford as well from
really
Memphis,
good, really good.
Right. You got Drew Barham as well. Like you got all these, and not only are they Memphis dudes, but they're freshmen.
Yeah.
Right? They're freshmen. And I think people think that they're supposed to just come in. So how do you navigate that? Right. Like, is it every time you get done with the game, is there phone calls to be made or there meetings?
Oh no, it was all the time. It was constant management the entire time. And so, yeah, you were dealing that a lot. You know, as I evolved into, as I kept, you know, moving a couple more years into my career as a head coach, after games, I would just eventually just say, hey, when we won the game, I'd be like, hey, look, winning is hard. And then, you know, and so
that's the KO thing. That's KO's deal. Yeah. KO, and I think he took it from Larry Brown. I don't know, but KO.
I used to always say that at Memphis, and people hit on, I say winning is hard. Winning one game is hard. And I literally would tell our team, I was trying to win every possession. I was coaching every single possession. But after the game, we have a win. I would see it. My phone would be having mess. I learned, man, I'm going to enjoy the win. I'm going to savor the win. I'll deal with it tomorrow, because I just know there was going to be complaints. There's going to be stuff, but listen, that's not a Memphis issue. And I tell people this all the time that I've, you know, winning, like I said, winning is very hard. You don't take it for granted because it's very hard to do. The other teams are very well coached. You got a lot of good players. And we all deal with it, that when you, when you're dealing with, a kid or someone didn't play as much. And even if you win the game, that young man could be upset. Their coach, and they're going to want to know what's going on. That happens all throughout. I've just learned how to be better at dealing with it through experience.
Right.
Now that I've been at a high level, because I've been at a high level at the University of Arizona. It's, you know, at the very high, that's the very highest level. Even previously, before University of Arizona, I was with the Houston Hoops, my AAU team that I was coaching or then playing, which was the highest level of AAU teams. Then I was at Memphis, which was the highest level, both as an assistant and a head coach. And then the head coach of Georgia Tech, which is in the ACC, which is the highest level. So in college basketball or grassroots basketball, I've been fortunate that in my entire time, I've been at a very, very high level, Doug.
Sure.
And I'm saying that, not saying that I've been very clear that I've been very lucky. And I've gotten so many open breaks, and people are more deserving to be the head coach at Memphis and Georgia Tech than I ever was and can ever will be. I mean, I just, you know, that being said, I understand players, especially at the high level, because I've been around it. I've seen it. I know what goes on with it. I know how they get. How parents, the coaches, I understand it. I have a real, like I call it the get factor. I get it. And that when someone maybe doesn't play as much, kind of how some of the feelings are going to be. I understand it because I've been around this type of level my entire, and I'm not saying, I'm sure this happens even at all levels. And I know it does, but I understand it at the highest level in college athletics.
If I were to have advised you at the time, okay. And now obviously hindsight is so 2020. I would have said the messaging should have been, okay, I love Coach Cal, but I want you to understand, it really was like a 5-year build to get to be an elite program. It's like a 5-year build. Third year, you got the NCAA tournament. Fourth year, you won a game in the NCAA tournament, I think. But it wasn't until fifth or sixth year that you actually hit. And so what people have to understand is, like, if you want a short term, like we want to just try, let's just go and now obviously it's changed with the transfers. You want a short term, okay, but if you believe in me, or if you believe in this program and how to build it, and I'm here and I'm telling you I'm here for the long run, trust me, but because we lost a whole recruiting class, we're going to have a couple years of a build, and there'll be some ups and downs, but I believe it can get, because that's actually what happened, right? It was like your fourth year, your fifth year, you end up having that incredible season where you go undefeated in league play. And that's honestly, that's for the most part at a program at the level of Memphis, which is a very high level, but it's not Kentucky, right? Kentucky should and can win 30 a year or close to 30 a year. With like once every 4 or 5 years, you're going to have a down year. And once every 4 or 5 years, you're going to have a national championship. With Memphis, if you're doing it right, it should be a build and then hopefully stay as consistently at the top. And again, occasionally you're going to have injuries, whatever. Like, I think that's, I don't know if people want to hear realistic positivity, but that's the realistic positivity.
No, I understand that. But I was very clear with everybody that, hey, look, I mean, because everybody knew, you know, I told everybody how, you know, hey, Coach Calipari, I mean, what he did has never been done in the previous 4 years. So the only way to repeat that probably is to try to get him to come back. And I don't think he's coming back. So we're going to have to like move forward. And I was more just like hitting the elephant in the room. Like, look, Coach Calipari is going to be in the Hall of Fame. I haven't coached a game. And so, you know, and my job is to try to rally. I felt it was, I had to rally the city. I was like, not only running the program, I was, you know, I wasn't, you know, in a sense, when you're the basketball coach at Memphis, you're almost like the mayor.
Yeah.
And I was sort of rallying this. I was trying to rally everybody because a lot of people were upset, not because they didn't like Coach Cal, because they loved him. They were mad. They were, they felt hurt that he left because they loved him so much. Obviously, you know, as time goes on, they look back and things are different, but, you know, but at that time, that's what, how the feeling. So I thought I had to really rally everyone to, and then when we had our first, I thought, you know, our, we called it Memphis Madness to start open our season in October, we had the place sold out. I didn't know if you'd even get the fire marshals had to come to shut, it was an overflow of crowd at the FedEx Forum. That's, and I told some people, you know, again, then we had to start playing some games eventually, but we really rallied the city, and the city got behind, everybody started, you know, coming, and that, you know, because I felt we did a good job of rallying the city and continue to keep them enthusiastic and keep them excited. And let me just say this, you know, during the Memphis job, the job has continued to change, because Memphis was originally in, I think it was Conference USA with like Marquette, Louisville, South Florida, all those schools. They all eventually left to go to the Big East. Memphis stayed. Louisville was in that initial. And then Memphis was just dominating. I mean, you remember Memphis had like a 60 some odd game winning streak in conference play of never losing. I happened to be, when I took over, I won some games to allow us to continue that streak. Eventually, we ended up losing it. But that was an amazing – I mean, for 4 years, Coach Calipari never lost a conference game. Think about that. I mean, 18-0 or whatever, 16 plus the three games. And so 19 for four straight years.
What was it like when you lost that game?
Oh, I was sick to my stomach. I felt terrible. The city was upset. Everybody was upset. Everyone was really upset because it was the first time they had lost in a long time. I felt responsible. It was a long sleepless, many sleepless nights after that. But when you look back at that and you say, man, the streak that he had created to do that was just amazing. And so I think that was, but the league has changed. So then when I was there, we eventually moved into the big
AAC,
the AAC, which had all the teams, if you remember. Had like Cincinnati, UConn,
Louisville won the national championship that first year.
Correct. So the job changed, and then some of those teams left to go. You know, obviously Louisville in the ACC, UConn back to the Big East. You know, South Florida stayed in there. I mean, South Florida went from the Big East into the AAC. So things changed, and it has changed. Houston then came in, so things had changed through that time. You know, because of the amount of times the league has, Memphis has changed leagues or teams moving in and out of the league.
What actually happened? Why'd you leave?
Well, look, Doug, I think I was there for seven years. And I really think what happened was, you know, we did a lot of good. Like I said, I had such great players, great staffs, great people that I worked with me, and it was just, you get to a 7 year, you're following John Calipari. I mean, you know, you get to the point where probably I couldn't go outside. I couldn't go to a restaurant. The upsetness for people. And I took it personal because I wanted to win so bad. I was so attached to every game, every possession. It probably was unhealthy. I'm better now, but because I knew what it meant to the city. And so when the Georgia Tech job opened, I, from afar, I was looking like, and that's a great job. It's in Atlanta. They just, you know, I mean, you know, the coach that had been there before I took over was Brian Gregg, who did a really good job. He's a very good basketball coach. He's at South Florida now. But I looked at maybe the program needed a shot of energy. And then you're in Atlanta, you're in the ACC. So I felt, man, this is a good opportunity. And I just felt it was the time, and fortunately, I had an opportunity to take this job and get the job. And like I said, when I came in here, I've said it many times. Brian Gregory did a great job with, you know, I was in a coming in, you know, as much as I had a, you know, we had to build some things back. He left it in a great position. It just needed a little shot of energy. The culture was great. We had some great players coming back, and then boom, you know, we had some, you know, we've been able to continue to build on that from that. So. It's just one of those things, Doug, that, you know how it is. It's hard to stay at a place overly long now these days, I think, you know, if that's the case. But I think part of it was also because of where we started. I started taking something over at the very highest of high levels, and trying to sustain that, you know, is not an easy thing.
My thanks to Josh Pastner. It's just been crazy. Like, I don't even know if you go to Bet Rivers, how you bet on some of this stuff, other than trying to just have the feel with it. You know, like, the second I saw Kawhi was out, though I thought the Clippers, no chance of winning the championship, they were a 3-point dog. I thought they had a very good chance of winning, and sure enough, they did win. But the NBA playoffs have been intriguing. And then what happens next in the rest of the league? Fascinating. Fascinating. Part three coming of Josh Pastner. We'll drop it in 2 days. I'll give you some more NBA nuggets. In the meantime, I'm Doug Gottlieb. This is All Ball.